Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Thursday, August 22nd, 2002. Today's forum is titled, The Middle East. Does the War on Terrorism Justify U.S. Policy Vis-a-vis Palestine and Iraq? Let's listen in.
I've been at the village here for 4 weeks, and this is my final action before we leave tomorrow. And I'm privileged to simply chair this meeting. Regularly at Holden Village, one or two nights a week, we take a night out to actually discuss some of the issues that are going on. It can be everything from homosexuality in the church and the like, which we did several weeks ago, and a number of other issues. And as we all know, the issue of terrorism and what's going on in the Middle East is one that's really heavy on the hearts of many people. And I come from Australia, and so I look at it from the outside and see things, and we see things in Australia that we see things on the television, for example, in Australia that we very often apparently don't see so much here. So we get, I think, a bit more balanced picture, although our Australian government is basically saying, we love you, Bush, we love you very much, and they do everything possible to agree with him and be the best friend that he can have. However, the television does provide us with a bit more balanced picture, I think. And so I'm delighted to have this opportunity to have this panel talk. The procedure is basically to have each of the panelists talk for 5-10 minutes and then open it up for discussion, because people are asking questions and are concerned and may have views and may have ideas. There's two sides to the discussion, or two aspects of it, I think. One is to know what really is going on as much as we can in each of the countries that are involved. And we have people who know about Iraq and Palestine and other parts of the Middle East like Bahrain. And what we'll do is ask them to tell us something about what's going on in each of those places, and then also look at the question of what in fact terrorism is and how it's been understood. If I think back 5 years ago, I don't think I heard the word hardly, and now suddenly it's the great evil, and where did it come from in its current understanding? Where did the idea of it, the construct of it, happen? So basically, well, that sets the stage, and we'll discuss it and debate it after each of the three panelists have had a chance to present a few minutes background. There's a lot more that can be known about each of the areas, but we'll at least try and give you a brief introduction. So I'm going to start with Ron Molavida, who is familiar with the world of Iraq, and will give us an introduction to the situation there and his perception of what's going on. Thanks, Ron.
I'm a pastor at University Lutheran in Seattle, and when our part in the Gulf War commenced in 1990, I was serving a congregation in Washington, D.C., and so I had the experience of being right there in the heart of our federal government during that entire period, and still remember the fanfare after we supposedly discontinued our bombing there and brought our troops back and brought our armament back, and the entire mall was displayed with all of our military arsenal. It cost $12 million just to set up that entire celebration with all of our kids climbing all over that armament, and that was our celebration of supposedly the end of that particular phase of the Gulf War. However, we all know that subsequent to that, based upon some agreements with Saddam Hussein and his government, that there was a contingency of inspections for nuclear weapons and other biochemical weaponry and then the economic sanctions were imposed to put pressure on him to comply with that agreement. And that has basically gone on now for 12 years. The economic sanctions continue, not in the strict way that they were originally administered, but nevertheless, they continue. And just to jump from there to my current involvement and interest, I'm a part of a network in Seattle, Washington, of people who have been very active in what is going on in Iraq and the United States' relationship with Iraq in particular. Friends of mine have been going to Iraq for the last 4 years. Delegations from Seattle and other parts of the country taking medical supplies. Two friends of mine, Randall Mullins and Bert Sachs, who went in 1999, have been fined $10,000 by the U.S. government and threatened with 5 years imprisonment. If in fact they do not pay the fine, they don't plan to pay the fine, but they bring back a lot of information of what's going on and what is happening over there, as well as a lot of other organizations that are providing aid over in Iraq. But basically, as I'm sure many of you read and know, there's been an estimated $1 million to $1.2 million deaths, supposedly contributed to that toll by our economic sanctions. Others will attribute most, if not all, of those deaths to Saddam Hussein and his failure to help his own people. So you have this whole spectrum of pointing the finger and laying blame. You know, who's responsible for all of these deaths? Well, one way that I deal with that is, even if we are responsible for 10% of all of those deaths in Iraq, that's still 120,000 people, mostly children and women. That's too many. And we know that over the course of the last 12 years, there's been two prominent people who have been administrators of the exchange for oil or exchange for food program in Iraq, who have resigned, career people, saying this is not working, it's killing people here, and we need to discontinue our economic sanctions. Currently, in terms of the Bush administration and all of the rhetoric about embalming Iraq, commencing to do that as our next step in this war on terrorism. Again, friends of mine who have come back from Iraq report that in 1998 to the middle of 1999, we actually attacked Iraq 64 times, had 64 bombing raids on Iraq. We don't hear about that in our press anymore. A colleague of mine, a pastor at the University Temple United Methodist Church, and another colleague went over there just 4 months ago. The report was that there were 10 U.S. bombing raids on Iraq since the beginning of 2002. We don't hear about that. Even our own congressional people are saying, you know, whether they agree or disagree with the administration, they're talking about we'll commence bombing. Well, bombing continues. And we just don't get that word back here in the States. Obviously, that, you know, in terms of Saddam, because he's the focal point of most of our administration's rhetoric, he is not one to be loved in terms of his own people. You know, will speak out against him, but nevertheless, there are other ways besides bombing and attacking and going to war in ways that could be dealt with, is outstanding. As we read, as you read in the papers, just this last week, I mean, we still get papers up here at Holden Village. Prominent Republicans are coming out against any kind of war against Iraq. And there's a lot of questions about whether or not there's any validity to such step in our efforts at this point.
Sure, thanks. I think we'll just have the three people speak and then Jonathan, Ferris.
I'd like to approach something that relates to Iraq and to the Palestinians under the umbrella of this war on terrorism, and say to you that I think it's basically taking something that you see on t-shirts and pretending that that's an adequate policy. So I put on the board t-shirt diplomacy, and I put up two t-shirts that I see when I go to Jerusalem. The first one says, peace through superior force, and the t-shirt has a tank, and it says peace through superior force. And I just want to relate that to an impression very strong in my last visit there. Is it peace through superior force when the other side is reacting to what you've done and then you're counter-reacting? Take the suicide bombers and take the reaction to the suicide bombers from the Palestinians against the Israelis and the Israelis against the Palestinians. I get a very distinct feeling when I was there in April that this intifada, this uprising, is not really a popular uprising because it's gone violent. And if you're a Palestinian, unless you're going to be a suicide bomber, and there have only been, 117 out of 3.5 million Palestinians have chosen that route, how many are actual gunmen? How many are actually willing to get out there and use a weapon to shoot at Israelis and to make this a fight? All the rest feel like this is not their fight, the kind of fight they would take, because they don't agree with the violence. And so this doctrine that you see for years in Israel saying peace through superior force reminds me of a little bit of our war on terrorism approach, that we're just going to go there and pound them until we get rid of them, and then the problem will be solved. Did it work in Afghanistan? Well, sort of. Is it going to work in Iraq? Has it worked in Iraq? We bombed them for 12 years since we went to war with them. And all we've done is killed 1.2 million children and women and made Saddam impossible to get in any other way. There are alternatives to force. There's now an international war crimes tribunal. Saddam Hussein should be indicted, and we should be doing everything imaginative and creative we could do to bring that man to justice. Milosevic is there. Did you ever think Milosevic would be in the court of justice getting tried for what he did in Serbia? And this is an incredible step forward that is the opposite of a war on terrorism. It's the rule of law at the international level, the opposite of the war on terrorism. And I just think when George Bush, and I don't want to stigmatize him, but when our leaders speak so simply and cleanly about they are evil, we must root them out, we must smoke them out, this simple, idiotic language about the world. Axis of evil. You know, if you're an Iraqi, you're part of the axis of evil. If you're an Iranian, you're part of the axis of evil. If you're a North Korean, you're part of it. It's just ridiculous. Have you ever been to Iran or Iraq? Have you met an Iraqi? Anybody met an Iraqi?
Yes.
Yeah.
Did they have horns?
No.
Were they carrying a pitchfork? You know, these are people exactly like us. There's some people come to Holden who lived in Tunisia, in Libya, and they just can't tell you how nice the Libyan people are. And all we think about is Gaddafi and terrorism and Pan Am 103. So I'm just saying that it's really not helpful to take leaders and nations and paste them with this kind of language and pretend that that is anything except the most ridiculous demagoguery. To build up this idea of a war on terror. We've called now Israel carte blanche our ally in the war on terror. Anything they want to do to the Palestinians is fine with us because this is terror and we're fighting terror. Absolutely ridiculous union between two separate problems. One is our relationship with the world, which we'll hear from Bahrain in a minute. The other one is Israel's problem with the Palestinians, which needs to be figured out. They need to share that land. But we've basically given them a carte blanche. And so I put up here, don't worry, America, Israel will protect you. That's what you buy on this t-shirt in Jerusalem. And we're almost saying, yeah, go ahead. You know, do whatever you need to do. It just makes not a drop of sense. And I would just suggest to you, how can this possibly be possible for the president of a country of 280 smart and educated people, 280 million smart and educated people, to be able to get away with a politics, a foreign policy, that is placed at the level of about a fifth grader? And the idea of a war on terror as a global fight is just, you know, it's just the most ridiculous, thin idea you could hear. There are problems out there, but there are ways to get at them without treating it as a war on terror. I can't say enough about how badly it looks when you're not in this country. How completely ridiculous. Has any other country supported us on the idea of going to war with Iraq? Nope.
Or Israel.
Are they all Israel? Are they all dumb? Are they all wrong? It's just, but are we outraged? Are we telling Bush that he's going to lose his job if he keeps telling us stupid things? And Rumsfeld? And Cheney? And Richard Pearl? I mean, they're getting us ready. They're getting us ready to do a ridiculous thing. Will they be able to do it if they want to do it?
Yep.
Is this a democracy? Mm. It's just really hard to compute. I think something really to watch for is this whole idea of fusing a nation and a leader. So Iraq is synonymous with Saddam Hussein. And you can get away with talking that way, writing stories that way, making television that way, and nobody thinks beyond it. But if you just meet one Iraqi, you'd realize that this was a total sham of a way to describe a country. One of the oldest civilizations on the earth, fantastic people, just trying to live, trying to get by, selling everything they own just to scrape by in this ridiculous situation under sanctions that Ryan described. Same thing with Saddam, same thing with Arafat. Arafat's the problem? Give me a break. Arafat's not the problem. Sharing the land is the problem. Justice for the 3.5 million Palestinians is the problem. Security for the Jews is the problem. Arafat's not the problem. But we've said he is now, which Sharon wanted us to do, and had already said, and now we bought that line, and now we said we're not talking Arafat anymore. I mean, this is politics run at the level of, if not first grade, then second grade. I'm sorry. And the war on terrorism is the same approach to dealing with the world.
Now, Miriam, we'll just call her Miriam, and she's from Bahrain, and will tell us a little bit about what it's like to be a Muslim.
You are from an OPEC country, and you are a traditionalist. This is how you see the world. Now, when you see the world like this, you think in a way that is different than the way Westerners think. It is a way of living where family is important, where wanting peace is important, where wanting security is important, where your religion is the main thing you live by. They pray 5 times a day. The women pray usually at home, not in the mosque. They have prayer rugs, they point them to Mecca, they ask Allah to give peace to the world. They are not people that want to kill other people. Now, if they're in their families, they can take some of this off. They can take that off, and some of them can take this off. Some of them have to wear a scarf at all times. They only have to wear their abaya when they go out in public. And I teach in a school where every single woman wears a scarf all day long, and every single woman puts on one of these when they leave the building. They are peaceful people. They are friendly people. They cannot understand why America has Israel as the 51st state. And that's what they call Israel, the 51st state. A state that's treated better than any other state, if you want to know the statistics that we are learning more and more about. The OPEC countries have been trying for the last couple years, but they're all families that have been warring with each other as Bedouin tent people only since World War I. It's not been long since they were in tents with their leaders in the biggest tent. They want to be anti-Israel, anti-American by not buying the products. There are stickers on most businesses that have both of our flags with the slash through it and telling people not to buy those products. But it's kind of hard since most of the products there are franchises, and the Bahraini ministers, which are part of the Khalifa family, which runs Bahrain, own. And so they're hurting their own economy by not buying American. But what they're trying to do is take the economy and make our economy fall down so that we would stop supporting Israel. Al Jazeera. You think that's the most horrible radio TV station in the world. Let's think of it a different way. It is the CNN, the BBC, of the Arab world. It is the newscasters that give them the point of view in Arabic. They were the ones in Afghanistan because none of the CNN thought Afghanistan was important. Until we started bombing there, and then CNN came, and then they couldn't get all these tapes. But Al Jazeera was there before them, just as newscasters trying to get the whole story. Al Jazeera has been kicked out of Baghdad. They're down in Qatar. They have a big TV group like we do in CNN. Not that big, but I mean that think of it as that kind of a world. One of its newscasters was down in Portland, and my sister took me there for lunch, and we listened to one of the men explaining this to us and asked what ideas do we have for Americans to like us better. And one of them we suggested is that maybe they do the Arabic do English subtitles so we can know what is being said so we don't think it's all against us. They say 60% of their news is for America. 40% is the other side. So Al Jazeera is not our enemy. Most of the Middle East is not our enemy. But our perception of them is. Anything else you want me to say?
I'd love more in a minute. But that's great. Thanks for all three of you. What we'll do now is just in order to get the thing rounded out, we'll have questions about Iraq first, then about Palestine, and then about the Muslim world, and sort of then leave it wide open. But maybe we'll start with Iraq first.
I'd just like to make an initial comment. You would introduce this as being an overview of conditions, but I've really heard a one-sided presentation with words like idiotic and stupid and give me a break, all directed towards the alleged idiocy of this country. And I just think that makes it awkward for those that may hold another side to be speaking out freely with that kind of an introduction. It was kind of uniform. That's just a pre-comment.
Okay.
Okay, well, I take the point, but for the moment, let's see, we can focus on Iraq first. Particular questions about Iraq, and I'm aware that people are going to have different opinions. I stand in a different world, I live in a different country, so people will have different opinions, that's understandable. Starting with Iraq.
Yes. Yeah, well, you know, Iraq kind of declared a holy war, and they're doing everything. I mean, Saddam Hussein, he wants to get rid of the United States. So it's not us who declared a war against him. He declared a war against us.
You want to comment on it?
There's a long history there. I mean, Saddam was our ally. And he really went to war against Kuwait, not against us. And it wasn't until we then entered into that war and went after Iraq and bombed the heck out of the infrastructure of Iraq, which is still pretty much the same way it was 12 years ago after our bombing. His war was directed towards Kuwait, not towards us.
And Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, he hasn't ended his war.
Oh, no. But he didn't declare it against us.
Oh, yeah. He mentioned many times.
Oh, he has now that we have come and attacked him, sure, and attacked Iraq. But initially it was really a feud in that region between Iraq and Kuwait, Saudi Arabia. When I was back in Washington, D.C., Vice President of Mobile Oil Corporation was a member of our congregation. And when Saddam went into Kuwait, and we were afraid that he was going to go into Saudi Arabia and totally destroy our oil supply there, I mean, it was under that auspices that we then attacked Saddam. He informed me afterwards that some of the major oil ports were 90 miles south of the Kuwaiti border. 90 miles. It would have taken Saddam nothing to get to those oil fields and supply places and utterly destroy them before we ever got close. But he didn't. His issue was with Kuwait.
Okay, question about that.
Well, just a brief comment that this doesn't appear to be that it was largely a policy that had been formatted not only by the United States but also by the pre-colonial country of Britain. The gentleman that I know quite well told me as a boy that the British would bomb them on a regular basis also for their things that they weren't doing right. And their rebellions. And they were also always aligning themselves, it seems, that with the people who wanted to throw off the colonial influences. And so they would get punished for that. And I was sitting with him when the war started, with the active Desert Storm started. And Wolf Blitzer was on CNN from Baghdad. And he looked at that and he just said, well, Americans can do what the British couldn't do, they have more planes. And that was his only remark, that he didn't see any difference in the policy towards Iraq, that it hadn't changed since colonial times, and that nobody had thought their way out of this box.
Okay. Other questions about
I think in the last month, before coming here, there is beginning to be a big backlash on this Bush's and Rumsfeld's policy, and it's coming out more and more, especially if you watch C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. They're not controlled at all. Mm-hmm. But what I don't understand from all, Scott Ritter's been very adamant about all this year. What I don't understand is why are Bush and Rumsfeld wanting to do this? What's in their mindset that's making them The other day, Rumsfeld was having a press conference. Somebody asked him a question. He wanted to talk about Afghanistan, and somebody asked him a question about Iraq, and he said, "Now you media, stop doing that. We don't want to talk about Iraq. We're going to talk about Afghanistan today." And I thought, oh my gosh, what's going on? What's in their minds that they're doing this?
They may know.
I don't know. I've been trying to figure this out.
Fortunately, perhaps it's not a winnable war against Iraq. That they already say that Baghdad is just there's complete tunnels, underground tunnels. That Saddam is built under Baghdad. He has 400,000 troops there. It would have to be in hand-to-hand fighting. And so the airplanes wouldn't do it, regardless of the bombs that they have. Additionally, that 80% of the population, this is what I've heard, have never known anything but Saddam Hussein.
Right.
That's right. Yeah. Can I elaborate on that question? We get attacked by Al-Qaeda, and like 40% of whose membership are Saudis. Of the people that actually did the suicide action, 18 of them were Saudis?
Right.
And yet Saudis are allowed to come into this country without being checked at the border.
And
instead of putting pressure on Saudi Arabia, we're suddenly focusing on Saddam Hussein again. And that makes no sense to me. And my understanding, at least, is that a lot of the whipping up of the anti-American hatred is actually happening in our supposed ally in Saudi Arabia.
Okay,
I think you... Go ahead.
I just want to point out that because Israel is only one country among Middle Eastern, like Iraq, Syria, Iran, or others. This is my opinion. Sometimes that causes problem because Israel have fear of their security. So when they see that Iraq is building up armies or navies or whatever, so their fear is that it's going to be harming Israel. So that's one of the main reasons that you see all these things going on around the circle, because Israel doesn't want Iraq to have to build up any armies because of their fear, and neither the other Arab nations. Because the moment Arab nations, they start to become united, to become friends with each other or have peace with each other, Israel does not want that because it's going to be danger its interests. So that's one of the main reasons, that all Arab countries start having fight with each other because of that. Things going on around the circle, and so you have to make sure that you not to miss that point.
Good. Well, maybe we can move on to Palestine, since you've raised that question there. Palestine, questions you want to put to Ron first?
To John.
Not John, sir.
I have something to say, that the conflict between the Jews and the Arabs is rooted back for 700 and has to do with the pigeon. And I don't know if it'll ever be settled. It's just...
I don't believe that God intended any of the people to be hopelessly lost in conflict. I think that it's soluble. I think it's sort of throwing creation back in God's face if we say that these people are doomed to fight each other forever. I just totally don't believe that that's necessary.
It's in the Quran. That's the problem.
It's in the Quran. That's the problem.
Yeah.
Well, what about the simple fact that Palestinians have been living on that land since... the Philistines.
Moses.
Since the Philistines, since before the Israelis arrived. The Israelites arrived. And they both think it's their home. They need to share it. They have an ally who could help them share it. We've never forced the issue. I think that would trump the religious issues immediately. I think the religious issues are they're an excuse. They're an excuse for not solving, for not being honest about what the problem is, and for not putting pressure to bear on the powerful to share some of what they've taken with the people they took it from. And the Palestinians would make a deal on 22% of their original homeland. 22%. They've been offered 11%. They won't take 11. They'll take 22 of what they owned in 1947. And we think that they are the people who are digging in their heels, because our media tells everything, virtually everything, from the Israeli point of view. And that's no way to make peace. That's way to keep a bag over your head. That's the way to become part of the problem rather than part of the solution. There's some real basic stuff needed, like two people, one land, share it fairly, or sort of fairly, but not the way it's being shared right now.
Yeah. Can I ask a stupid question? Why is it that we do only hear, or we do generally hear primarily the Israeli side of the story? I mean, I know, of course, historically that the U.S. was instrumental in setting up the, you know, getting the nation of Israel going and that. I mean, are we talking, is it people high up in politics in the U.S.? I mean, what is it, economic forces? Why are we not hearing the other side of the story?
So in Australia, for example, I'll just be clear on a minute. When we see the news, we do see quite a bit more, I think, both sides. When we see what happens at Jenin, and you see the tanks coming in and just running over the houses, and the people who are fighting back have just got stones, you see a very different picture. And you do see suicide bombers. Both sides of it are given results of what a suicide bomber does. And so both sides, I think, are portrayed a bit more in some other countries. But why it is that in this country that's not seen is probably a good question.
I suspect, in answer to your question, that there's a vast number of influential Jews in this country that are lobbying and do have sway with the government and with the media. And that's
my sense, but
will have a bearing on it.
Yeah.
And were we to have a vast number of influential, wealthy Palestinians here, it could well be the other way.
I
was going to say, I feel like it's now become a real political ball that when Clinton was in office, he did try to have some kind of peace negotiations happening. But now with Bush, he sort of aligned himself with the Christian fundamentalists, and now the Jews are aligning with that. I mean, you read today that Jeb Bush is going to have Ariel Sharon come. Right before the election.
Is that right?
Yeah, before the primary, Jeb Bush is going to be coming to help support. I mean, Sharon is coming to help support Jeb Bush.
Absolutely.
It's in the New York Times.
Well, where do Jews go in the winter, you guys?
Miami Beach.
Well, and if you want to look at some of the other things that are happening, that would support that.
Well, apparently, originally, they went to South America because they want to welcome here. There are more Bethlehemites in Bolivia, I understand, than there are in Bethlehem, I was told. So there's a lot of them in South America.
Another reason why you don't see, I'm in Bahrain, I see a lot more than you do, obviously. My newspapers are loaded with what's happening to the Palestinians. But the Israelis double screen anything coming through to the West.
In fact, after footage was released from, I think it was in Bethlehem or one of the other cities, when the rumor went out in the community that the curfew had been lifted, but it had only been lifted for students to go take exams, but people didn't realize that, so they thought it was okay to go out and shop for bread. And so they went out and filled the streets to go shop, and then the Israeli soldiers shot them. Now, some of you maybe saw ABC News that. Now, I saw that footage, and it closed with, you know, the person went out to shop for bread, and now it was saturated with blood, and children were killed. Immediately the next day, not in headlines of, I'm from Portland, Oregon, of the Oregonian, but Israel snapped down with media restrictions. It was not a headline in the Oregonian that had happened. but it was a 2-inch little article buried way back in the inner pages saying that Israel now had media restrictions, that no journalists or media could be any place where the IDF was. So they don't want us to see those images. So that's the first way that they control it. The second way is internally, because there are Palestinian journalists. This is with the curfew. Those journalists are not able to go out and gather and file their stories, because they also, you know, are locked and have to be, you know, in their homes. In some areas, the curfews have lasted up to 28 days without people being able to go out. Some international organizations now say that 50% of the Palestinian children are now malnourished. 50% of the women now are anemic.
Yes.
Peter Finch from The Independent, I believe he's a British journalist, UK journalist, said it, and I feel it all the time too, that if you come out too strongly for the Palestinians, you're either labeled anti-Semitic or somehow a traitor to this country. And those are so powerful that you can't, you hope that people will see the subtleties in your argument, but those are damning things, and you don't want anyone to misinterpret your sympathies in either way. And so those hard words, anti-Semitic or a traitor, keep people silent.
People want to ask some more questions of Miriam about what it's like to be a Muslim or a Muslim woman. It's a very different world than...
Well, it's a rich country, you know. It's a rich country compared to the rest of the Arab countries.
Mm-hmm. Kuwait's richest, and they know it.
Yeah, you know, so they have a different perspective. Mm-hmm. Than most of the rest of the Arab countries.
There are more, the most traditional country is Saudi Arabia, partly because Medina and Mecca are there, the two holy cities of the Hajj. The Hajj is one of the five things you do as a Muslim, as part of your religion. And that is to take a pilgrimage to where Muhammad did his enlightenment and where he was born. But it is, and they're having troubles financially, because the only export they have is their oil. And of course they're very top heavy on management. And these families have lots of children. You can have up to 4 wives as a Muslim, as long as you treat them all equally.
Must be hard.
But they have, Bahrain was smart enough to know they couldn't live just on oil, and they had diversified. They diversified quite a bit. So that's why it's a richer country than some of the other countries. It's very small, about the size of Singapore.
Palestine is very poor. They don't have any oil either. That's kind of
Palestine has the water, though, and Israel doesn't have the water.
And Israel controls it.
Yes. Israel controls it.
But it's Palestine.
It's not Palestinian land.
Can I ask a question about the Palestinians that are outside of that are not in the occupied territory, but are actually, after 40 or 50 years, still in refugee camps in Lebanon and Jordan and different places? It is troubling to me that after the Second World War was over, there were mass numbers of people displaced in Eastern Europe who were brought into countries in the West and allowed to settle there. And they had less in common sometimes with the people than the Palestinians, as Arab-speaking Muslims would with their Arab brethren in the Middle East. I don't understand why those people are in refugee camps at this point and have not been embraced by their own brethren. And that is not to say there's a justice issue in Palestine, but let's face it, Palestine is an area that is maybe the size of 3 counties of Western Washington, and there's 3 million people or something in refugee camps still.
There's 5 million in refugee camps in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, and maybe Egypt. I'm not sure about Egypt. They haven't been embraced. I mean, the camps are solid concrete buildings now. They look just like parts of the city, but they're still called camps because the countries that host them feel that what was done was wrong.
and it's never been righted. And these people need to be able to go back to their land because that land was stolen. And it should be taken in by their kinfolk is to pretend that Arabs are Arabs. Arabs aren't Arabs. The word Arab relates to the Arabic language more than anything else. And it's a very successful and broadly used language from Morocco to the gates of Iran. But they're different ethnic groups. They're different geographic origins, different tribes. And so they don't feel like this is my cousin and I'm bad because I don't accept him into my country. They think this is a Palestinian. I'm a Jordanian. Jordan is more than half Palestinian. It lives already, the people who are citizens, is 70% probably Palestinian because so many have been integrated and were already there at that particular place. And the Israelis like to play on that and say, Jordan is Palestine. Go there. But the real core of Jordan is the Bedouins from Mecca. King Hussein's family is from Mecca. He's like a second stringer to be the king of Saudi Arabia. And here's a point we need to say. We said Saddam Hussein attacked us. Well, how much do we want to go back into history? And we don't have to go very far. Because remember the Iran-Iraq war? The whole decade of the 80s, with incredible casualties, human waves, the Revolutionary Guards, you know, madness on both sides. Who was supporting Saddam? Us.
Because we didn't like Ayatollah.
Yeah.
We always have an enemy over there.
We have a problem with Muslims, and then we do these incredible things in response to our problem with fundamentalist Muslims. What we should ask ourselves, why do we hate fundamentalist Islam so much? What are we scared of? What we're creating the boogeyman that we're so scared of by being so polarized against it. But just go back a little bit more. Saddam took over in about 69, 67. He took over from King Idris, I think. Who's King Idris? King Idris is the descendant of the another little royal family that the British and the French plucked out of Mesopotamia and said, you're going to be the king of Iraq. In 1917, if you want to read stuff that makes sense, go back to 1917 and read about the agreement between the Sykes-Picot Agreement between the French and the British, done at a junior level by colonial officers to kind of do right by both England and France so that England would be connected to India, right through the Middle East, and that France would have Syria and Iraq and a couple other things that it would get its pride sustained as the colonial empires fell after World War I. They divided up the land, literally on the back of a notepad, and they say, oh, that's why he attacked Kuwait, because it was a province of the Ottoman Empire that went with Iraq. He had a beef. But they created a little oil state, Kuwait. They put a royal family in charge and said, here, it wasn't an oil state yet, but little did they know, it was rich. Same thing with Iraq, same thing with Saudi Arabia, same thing with Jordan, same thing with Palestine.
They didn't Bahrain too.
Bahrain too?
The British, there's a book called Desert Queen. It's the story of Gertrude Bell. She is one of the ladies that, because she kind of hobnobbed with some of these sheikhs, they help with these borders, and the borders have to do with something called O-I-L. What does that spell, everybody? Oil. Why do they have oil? Because we have to have it. The British had to have it for their ships.
Yeah.
When they went from steam and from sailing and getting into oil, they needed oil. That's the only reason why they care about the Middle East. If there wasn't any oil there, these would be the poorest countries in the world.
And the way to control the oil is to have a friendly royal family.
And that's
the House of Saud was... Yeah. King Hussein's family had a rival claim to be the Sheikh of Medina, of Mecca. Mm-hmm. But they picked House of Saud. He was one of many chieftains. And one, you know, Saud himself in the 20s or 30s took over and made the modern Saudi Arabia.
Desert Queen is a very good book to read to understand the history that caused this problem to happen.
Yeah, so, you know, by way of summary, how does this relate to our discussion? That's why I use these strong words. I'm sorry if that's not the way to start a panel, but I think...
I just want to see an objective. Strong words are okay, but objective.
Well, I think they're objective. If we think our problem is Saddam Hussein, we are saying that history began in 1990 when we didn't quite whoop him and we have to go back and do it again. Go back. Look how it came to be. We have a drug. We have an addiction. It's called petroleum. And it's related to every car we drive, every ounce of energy we crank up the thermostat, and our sense that we get to control the world and use the resources to keep our great economy running. And that drives this kind of politics where you try to dominate each of those countries. They're not democracies. The Israelis love to say they're the only democracy in the Middle East. Well, of course they're not democracies. If the only pressure they get from us is that the royal family gets to control the oil and then we get the oil at good rates. I mean, it's treating them like a commodity. And that needs to be said because Saddam Hussein looks like a genuine revolutionary when he comes to power because he's throwing this system over and we don't like him. And none of this gets said. We don't take any responsibility for it. And then we jump in with the problem that we've created and get mad that now he's getting weapons and using the oil money to make a big man out of himself.
Okay, now let me just talk about this oil one more time. Why are we such good friends with Putin all of a sudden? Russia. Why are we fighting their war in Afghanistan? Why are we helping them with their Vietnam War? We want that oil from Russia. We want to have a safe passage for that oil to go to a different part of the world so we can have that oil and not worry so much about the oil in the OPEC area. Watch. That's what's going to happen.
They're already building a pipeline.
Yeah. But that's why. It's for oil. Oil is running.
Pipeline across that.
Yes.
I wanted to say something about the refugees. They can go back there because Israel won't let them go back.
Right. But the Arabs won't absorb them because they want to keep them as a bargaining chip. They'll never go home.
See, that's the great game, though.
Yeah. But hey, the whole thing we've been talking about is a game, so why point the finger at that particular player? You know, when there is actually a genuine wrong that generated those refugees.
The Middle East.
You know, we solved our problem with the Jews and the Holocaust by thinking, yeah, they can have a homeland in Palestine after 2,000 years of absence. I mean, what were we doing with our brains at that point? It was the British, but I mean, we acquiesced.
I have a comment with respect to Israel. I certainly don't like the kinds of actions that Israel takes against the Palestinians in the retribution. But I think we have to also look at all sides in terms of the people. I know a woman who was a postdoc at the University of Minnesota from Israel.
Uh-huh.
And this is the last couple of years. The last time I saw her was about a year ago. She had a son who's about 16 and said she was really encouraging him to not go into the military. And as you probably know, I think it's the Orthodox Jews that do not have to serve in the military because of the religious unbelief. But everyone else does, men and women. This woman is not Orthodox. She was urging her son not to go into the military, which means they would have to spend, I think, at least a year in jail. But I said, well, I imagine that's rather dangerous duty. Well, no, she said, that's not the reason. It's the things you have to do if you go in. The times you have to man the checks so that people can't go places.
Right.
A pregnant woman should go to the hospital because the baby's not coming right, and you have to deny them that right.
Mm-hmm.
And she, you know, had other people who felt the same way. So on both sides, Palestinian Israelis, you don't have just one point of view. I think we tend to sometimes forget that.
And there are some very significant groups in Israel, Rabbis for Peace and various other groups that are trying to fight a very different
healthy debate
going on.
Press, it's on press.
Yeah. Okay.
We're kind of running down at the end of time here, and we've been going around the room pointing out all the problems, and ain't it awful, and this is how bad it is, and these are the non-thinking players, the idiotic people. What are solutions? What are proposed solutions? It's so easy to grumble, but what can we build on?
Okay, you
want solutions?
Well, John, and then we'll have each of the panelists maybe.
It seems to me that we have a good model for the Hague with the World Court. It seems that that would be one. And we do have the UN. We still need to use the UN. It's a good voice. I think that the dialogue would be helpful, and I think it's very essential right now.
Okay. Each of the three of the panelists want to...
We had another solution at the back.
I'm sorry.
Oh, I actually don't have a solution to the problem. But I did want to say that I do think there's an interesting relationship between the fact, Jonathan, that you were digging deeply into the historical roots of, and the implication of the West in setting up an abysmally unjust situation that is undergirding all of this violence. I don't see that kind of discussion as grumbling or pointing out, oh, it's too bad. I see that as an integral part of the solution. Mm-hmm. That perceiving the historical roots, without doing that, we can't come to a solution. Mm-hmm. So the task of us learning to analyze what's going on historically is part of the solution. But the juxtaposition I saw that was interesting was that you were naming the complexity and the, you know, seeming almost impossibility of the problem by looking at all of the historical dynamics, et cetera, and you were also saying that it's not inevitable that it continue this way. Remember a couple comments back, mm-hmm. that I don't see that it is... I see it as a defiance of God's creation if we think this has to go on. So I'm only speaking to point out that sometimes to say we see the complexity of what's going on and how it happened goes along with saying it doesn't have to go on that way. That's all I wanted to say. And I think those are two both very valuable things to do in one breath.
Mm-hmm. Okay, over here.
Well, according to the comments here, that oil seems to be the central problem, and so possible solution, this would be a long-term solution, would be to develop some substitute for oil. And certainly, with a resource, whatever is possible. And with the amount we spend on wars and sending all these troops and so forth, why not put that into something really productive?
The key question, however, in all of those, I mean, you can move to hydrogen fuel and all of those things, that's crucial, but the crucial question is how you get a government, an administration, to change its modus operandi. We can have all the great ideas in the world, but it really is a question of political will. And that's where we have to think of solutions, yes.
And, you know, as time-consuming as it can be, to educate yourself, to start to ask the questions about context. If you have internet, go to yahoonews.com, go to Middle East Conflict, start reading some of the background things, get international news, broaden your perspective. Contact your newspapers, either write letters to the editor, call the newspaper editorial boards and say that you want both, you want more balance, that this is an imbalanced picture that you're receiving, put pressure there, write and call to your elected representatives. The lobbying is very strong and very heavy for the for perspectives, which the more I've read in the context of the history, tell me that it's not just.
From my perspective, I mean, two things related to Iraq. The cessation of the "we're going to attack Iraq" rhetoric. I mean, that's a positive step, just the cessation of that rhetoric. I mean, the overarching theme of this evening's forum is war on terrorism. My question is, who are the terrorists in the world? I mean, in my son's lifetime, I mean, they have seen our efforts in the Gulf War and now in Afghanistan, I mean, and the attack. And we have an arsenal around this world that instills terror in other people around the world. Mm-hmm. Talk to people in developing countries. They are very much aware of who has the arsenal in this world, and it's the U.S. primarily. And people are in terror of what we could do. We've demonstrated that in the last 12 years. So this rhetoric of war, attack, needs to stop. And secondly, in terms of Iraq, the removal of the economic sanctions. That's a positive step. It has not, it's a failed policy. 12 years and it hasn't produced anything. It's a failed policy. We need to get rid of economic sanctions against Iraq.
I also think we need to get the UN into Israel and Palestine. And that means we have to write letters to stop the United States from vetoing it. The rest of America is bigger than Brooklyn, okay? We need to write the letters. We need to let them know that we don't want them to do this, that we want peace in that region. Because if you don't have peace in that region, and if the Middle East does get together, we're not a country anymore. In 250 years, we are not the big country anymore. You think it's bad now with the stock market? It's going to get worse unless we fight back. And that means writing letters and changing what's happening in D.C.
The Middle East is watching us to see if we'll do anything about the Palestinians. And if we did something about the Palestinians, for the Palestinians, some kind of justice, they might then play along, because they are our cronies. They might play along with something about Iraq. They don't like Saddam Hussein. But every single leader, you want peace in the Middle East, follow the plan of Crown Prince Abdullah. He made an enormous concession. Is it still in the news? I don't think so.
And Muharraq is giving lots of ideas in Egypt. I mean, they are trying to give to give some outs for this.
Do we believe that an Arab could make peace? I don't think some of us do. I think we have an enormous prejudice against the word Arab and against the people that are called Arab. I'd like to suggest, something for all of us to think about. What's the best thing about America?
Diversity.
Okay, what's behind freedom? Why do we think we have freedom?
Tolerance.
Why do we think we have tolerance? Think of our political system.
Oh, democracy to start with.
What makes a democracy good?
Well, it has to be representative government, and that the people have an opportunity to have a say.
Okay, the thing I think that applies internationally is. And not to go necessarily and say, you got to have a democracy like us. I think we have a government of laws, not of people, right? Not of men. And there's something in that that's very valid. But the minute you get behind our borders, the USA is an outlaw.
Right.
We won't sign any of the treaties.
Yeah.
Yeah. We won't sign. We're too good. What are we? This is why, I use this strong language. I go overseas and I come back. I just can't believe what we're doing. The whole world is shocked, outraged, but we're too powerful for them to say anything. Is that a good state of affairs?
No.
It's just incredible.
We couldn't believe it, for example, when the peacemakers would go into another country, but they were not to be brought before the war crimes tribunal or anything. The word was out that American soldiers fighting as peace team fighters
were where?
Anywhere.
They wouldn't join peacemaker
right,
force.
Right.
Yeah, because we don't want another officer to control our troops, and we don't want to have any of our troops be brought before an international.
And they would not. Yeah, they would not be brought before an international.
We are outlaws outside of our own country, and the strongest thing about our system is the rule of law, not of men. Now, compute that one.
Yeah.
If we want to make a change, start pushing to sign some of the treaties. Mm-hmm. The Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That should be stuffed down Saddam Hussein's throat by every one of his neighbors and by us, and down Israel's throat, and down Arafat's throat, to say, this is what your standards are, friends. We need to work with this. Stuff that relates to the well-being of the people instead of the well-being of the elites. And then we get somewhere in a world where we're not perceived only as pursuing our own interests in a very narrow sense that support a way of life that the planet can't support. It's related to lifestyle and what we think our prerogatives are. Very, very quickly, especially when you put face oil.
Ron, you want to weigh in? Oh, I'm sorry. No,
okay. One of the things we haven't mentioned is the political power of fundamentalist Christians in the U.S. And
I was just going
to. I was a little concerned about the number of comments about the rich Jews who control the media. And just this week, President Bush has taken out our money from the United Nations, all programs relating to women's health, because somewhere someone may get an abortion. Being beholden to the religious right, putting those folks in office is a big thing. And their left behind theology, which allies them with a lot of Israel's ideas in terms of saving Jerusalem. And we don't have to worry about ecology because the world is ending pretty soon and we're all going to heaven and everybody else will be tortured for eternity. That whole way of looking at what's going on is something that those of us in this room can do. When we go back to our neighborhoods and communities, talk one-on-one with our fellow Christians and ecumenical dialogues like this in our communities, to start changing some of those ways of perceiving what it means to be Christian and what it means to be Western that really have huge political power in the United States.
You said what I was about going to say in closing. I appreciate that because it's a second voice. We've heard a lot of political analysis, economic analysis. What about the theological? I mean, Time Magazine, July 1 issue of this year, talked about the whole left behind theology and that it was the greatest selling and read fiction in 2001. It is feeding the mindset of our American public. And what gave me a little insight into that was 3 weeks ago in the Seattle PI, there was a little article talking about the religious right organizations, churches, raising scholarship money to send Israelis back to Israel so they can hasten the Armageddon. It's based upon a particular reading of the book of Revelation, and it is the power of the religious right that is moving the many aspects of this country and our politics.
Now, Barbara Rossing, is she here?
No, she's not. She
Barbara Rossing.
She's been left behind.
Or we have.
Just so that you know, watch for it. Barbara Rossing is probably one of the, in the Lutheran circles, one of the best scholars in the book of Revelation. And just in brief summary, it's very clear if you read the last chapters of Revelation that the earth does not disappear. What happens is that the spiritual power of God from heaven comes and transforms earth.
That's right.
It's just the opposite. And so she's working on a book, which I hope to support her with, a book which is called Rapture in Reverse, which is designed to demonstrate precisely that the book of Revelation functions to be a future for earth, transformed rather than left behind. And just one piece of theology from my background, I've been working in Old Testament. And if you actually look very closely at the stories about Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and go back before the conquest, you will see that Abraham, as you know, Abraham is the father of both the Jewish and the Arab peoples.
And the Christians.
And the Christian people. So you've got all three. He's the father of all, and so is Sarah the mother of all. And if you look very closely at those stories, Abraham makes peace with everybody. Abraham is a peacemaker, and his model of how to live, have covenants with people, to worship the God of the land, the Canaanites are the host people, and you have a model of peacemaking with the ancestor that precedes all the rest of it. And Paul, interestingly, from our Lutheran perspective, goes back to the Abraham stories to understand the nature of the promise and God's role. And I would say if you want to start in your congregations to look at a model that might be biblical, go back to the Abraham stories. They are much better than the Joshua stories for helping us understand how to relate to both Arab, Christian, and Muslim. And Paul does that, which is an interesting thing to do as well. I think we've just about wound it up, and I know there are a lot more things you'd like to say, but if members of the panel want to say one more thing, otherwise, oh, you've got a chance to take everybody into the middle of the war.
Yeah, anybody want to come and dodge bullets in March next year in the Holy Land? With me, you're welcome.
I have one little story just to end.
Lutheran World Relief, steady visit to the Holy Land.
When I went through a checkpoint, the staff soldier had his semi-automatic pointing straight at me. And he looked at my passport and he said, Harville, you know what that means? And I shook him my boots and said, no. And he said, stupid. And I said, yes, 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 yes. So, but I don't think it's stupid having this discussion. Thank you very much for participating. Thank you.
Would it be good to close with prayer after?
Okay, let's do that. Thank you. Shall we all close? Rise and we'll say a prayer. Lord of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Sarah, Rebecca, and Jesus Christ, our Lord, we ask that you would this day send your Spirit to each of us that we might be moved to find ways of peace wherever we live, that you might send your Spirit to move the leaders of our countries, that they too might find ways of peace, that you might move in the hearts of all, in wherever they are, in whatever war-torn country, that the poor and oppressed might find hope, that the leaders might find courage to face the truth and find peace. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen. Amen.